At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter by the qualities that are most important to you. Then, book free 15-minute consultations with any therapist you're interested in seeing. And because 95% of therapists at Alma accept insurance, you can find care that's affordable too. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy30 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy30.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pod of thunder and rock and roll. I'll tell you someone that hasn't gotten a haircut, Glenn Danzig. That's right. And you know what else he hasn't done? He hasn't done what everyone thought he was going to do. As a matter of fact, he did quite the opposite. He's reunited with the Misfits for shows at two Riot Fests, one in Denver, Friday, September 2nd, this Friday. The second Riot Fest show takes place September 16th in Chicago. It's Danzig, bassist Jerry Only, guitar player Doyle von Frankenstein, and get this, former Slayer drummer Dave Lombardo behind the kit. This is the first time that Danzig has played with the Misfits since his very last show with them, October 29th, 1983 in Detroit. These shows are going to be legendary. You need to get tickets if you can. And much like the Guns N' Roses reunion, and when they just booked a few shows at first, I bet you that the Misfits are back and will be doing a lot more shows. Now, this interview here was recorded before Danzig announced his reunion with the Misfits, although we do discuss the possibility of it. And now that I know what I know, he was kayfabing me a little bit, which is great because this is a very rare Danzig interview. Danzig has never done a podcast before. Danzig very rarely does interviews, but I've known Glenn for 20 odd years. And when I asked if he would be on Talk is Jericho, he responded with open arms. I met up with him at Lemmy's birthday party back in December of last year. And I just ran into him and asked him if he wanted to do my show. And he said yes. And we made it happen. So Danzig is going to be talking all about the Misfits, the early days making a name for themselves at Max's Kansas City in New York City, and the circumstances around the original lineup's breakup. Plus, Danzig is not just completely back with the Misfits. He's also working on a new solo record, Danzig Sings Elvis. Yeah, seriously. He's taken on Elvis, and it's not going to sound anything like the Misfits. And if you think about it, Danzig does have kind of an Elvis type of a vibe, even an Elvis type of a voice, so it's not too far off. Danzig Sings Elvis. I want to hear that. He's also recently released another covers album called Skeletons. We're going to talk about all that music and comic books and wrestling and Rick Rubin and the time the Misfits video was banned by MTV. So much to talk about with the legendary Danzig. It's a great conversation. It's a rare conversation, and I know you're going to dig it right here on Talk is Jericho. You know what else you're going to dig on the Jericho Network? The brand new podcast, The Team Tiger Awesome Show on the Jericho Network. Listen, the guys are two episodes in. Episode 3 is dropping this Sunday. You got to check it out. If you loved Who's Hot and Who's Not, the Star Wars Symposium, Batman versus Superman, you are going to love The Team Tiger Awesome Show. The Irrelevancy. As a matter of fact, this week they had a contest if any fan would do some fan art of Helen Mirren and Vin Diesel making out, because that's where the topic went. And some fans actually did do that, so I retweeted it. So lots of hilarity on the Team Tiger Awesome Show, the second podcast signed to the Jericho Network. You should go check it out and do yourself a favor. Subscribe on iTunes. Subscribe to Team Tiger Awesome. Subscribe to Keeping It 100 with Conan. Huge runaway hit that one is. And of course, Talk is Jericho if you haven't done that as well. And while you're there, leave us comments and 5-star ratings. All right, do it, do it, do it. Danzig coming up.
Talk is Jericho.
So here in the undisclosed location studio in Hollywood with Glenn Danzig, and this is really cool, man, because I come in here and you're playing a guitar and you introduced me to a girl that you're in there with.
It's Cherie Curry from The Runaways.
And I got that after I saw her face. I'm like, oh my gosh. And you guys were working on a Patsy Cline tune.
Yeah, so what happened was she originally came down graciously and sang on a track for the Skeletons record, which is all covers. Mm-hmm. It just came out. But, and it came out great, but we couldn't use it because we changed some lyrics and the lady who's in charge of Lee Hazelwood's publishing wouldn't let us use it. And rather than getting a big legal thing, we just left it off. But I wanted to have a track on there with her. And so we're doing a track together, and hopefully it's going to be on a limited edition one with some extra tracks that didn't make it on the
So it's that specific in that if you change a line, they sometimes don't like that, publishers?
Usually nobody cares, you know what I mean? Mm. They're happy you're covering their song, and you're not really changing the integrity of the song or anything. So, yeah, we didn't think there would be a problem. And, of course, you know, anytime you cover someone's song, it's an homage to the person.
Of course.
You
know,
and so this is what we're doing now. But you're right, yeah, I love Patsy Cline, especially the early version of this song. Which is Walking After Midnight.
Oh, okay.
So it's way before it got, you know, overproduced, and she recorded it later. So it's a really cool version, and I'm making it a little darker, of course.
Danzigizing it.
Yes, that's what I'm doing. That's what I have to do.
But I love the concept of the Skeletons record because, like you mentioned, it was a cover record, and so people will be thinking, well, what are you going to be covering? Is it going to be punk stuff or Ramones or whatever? But it's very eclectic. Signifying your musical tastes.
Yeah, I see a lot of the fans know, but, you know, some other people may just think, you know, dancing, it's heavy or it's whatever, but mm-hmm. But yeah, my tastes are all over the place. I like everything from classical to black metal, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's all over the place.
I like the inclusion of Elvis too.
Well, yeah, so everyone knows I'm a big Elvis fan,
yeah.
You know, and I'm, you know, I'm actually doing a Dancing Sings Elvis record, you know. And one of the reasons for that is, you know, I'm a big Elvis fan, of course, but I'm thinking, and I'm like, I remember when artists would do a whole record and it would be like, so and so sings this.
Oh.
And nobody does it anymore. And so I was just like, you know, you're always doing Elvis songs live or, you know, whatever. We've done them before. And I just, you know, why don't I just do an Elvis record?
So you're doing a record, Danzig Sings Elvis.
Yeah, it's all done pretty much.
That's a great idea.
And so it's not heavy. It's not like, you know, a Danzig, like, you know, the Elvis track on the Skeletons record is pretty heavy.
Mm-hmm. Which track was it?
Let Yourself Go.
Right, okay, yeah.
So the new stuff that I'm working on for the Danzig Sings Elvis record is more like a traditional, you know, thing. So I'm not going to really tour anymore, but if we do some shows for the Elvis thing, we're going to do it in a very intimate, like, loungy kind of thing.
That's a great idea.
And just, you know, it's going to be a really cool thing. And, you know, we did this legacy show for TV, and the director, Mark Brooks, who does Metalocalypse, and now mm-hmm. he does that new show, Moonbeam City, I think it's called.
On Adult Swim?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He had the idea, he wanted to do this Danzig legacy special, but he wanted to make it like the Elvis 68 comeback special. And so when he finally pitched it to me and the managers, I was like, well, you know, I'm a big Elvis fan. I go, can we do the thing in the round. He did, you know, where he brought Scotty Moore back in the Memphis Mafia, were like banging on things, and he's just talking and really relaxed. I said, yeah, we have to do that. So that was my favorite part of doing it. And so the people there was only probably like 200 or 300 people maybe in the round. It was very intimate, and it was really my favorite part because we're just goofing off, telling jokes, playing the songs wrong, and but it was just a very cool, intimate thing. So I think I like something
did,
like
did
that.
Did you wear leather pants and a black leather jacket?
No, but I wore my leather jacket.
Okay.
I'm always wearing a leather jacket. I haven't stopped wearing one since 1970 or whatever.
That's such a cool look, though, when Elvis, I mean, that 68 comeback special.
No, yeah, he had the whole black leather
yeah,
suit.
And
I
that was
I
his,
didn't do that.
And that was his literal comeback. You hadn't seen him for years or whatever. He came back with like a cool, you know,
that
cool
was
hip
correct,
dude.
Yeah.
You know? Let me ask you this. As a singer and having your style and your range and your wheelhouse, when you're doing Elvis songs, because he's a tremendous singer.
Incredible range.
How do you try and fit that into the Danzig style, but still, you know, keep the Elvis, you know, vibe to it?
Well, here's the tough thing. I mean, in some ways, you know, because Elvis just kind of did Elvis, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when I'm singing, and I'm also screaming and howling too. So it's like, I mean, you're a singer, you're blowing your voice out.
Right.
You know how it gets.
Yeah.
And so keeping it salvaged every night, and so, you know, sometimes you're doing three in a row. I won't do four in a row anymore.
Yeah.
But even three in a row,
it's like, a lot,
you know, and doing what we're doing, and I'm not just standing there, so I'm running
Put
around
show,
crazy,
yeah.
You know, and it's not easy, especially to keep that, like you said, keep getting the low notes and the high notes, and so it's
which,
a job.
Which tunes are you doing that are the harder ones, the Elvis ones?
Well, again, you know how we talked about doing stuff on skeletons people wouldn't think that I would do. There's a couple on the Elvis, Danzig Sings Elvis record that people might expect. But then there's other ones they're not going to expect whatsoever. They're going to be like, what? But I can guarantee you they're going to dig it. I actually, we were just on tour and we were in Memphis and I was a guest on Elvis Radio on satellite in Graceland.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
So I not only get to take over, you know, Elvis Radio for an hour with the DJ and play my favorite Elvis tracks, but I played, of course, the Let Yourself Go heavy version. And then I played... You Were Always On My Mind from the Danzig Sings Elvis. So people got a taste of it, so they kind of know what to expect.
Cool.
Yeah, it was really cool being on that because I listen to Elvis Radio all the time. And I have friends like a Dez from Cold Chamber and from Devil Driver. They listen to Elvis Radio all the time. So, hey, Dez.
Shout out to Dez. You know what's amazing to me, too, is people forget as the years go by just how huge Elvis was, you know, how monumental. Similar to like the Beatles are kind of a generation later, but 10 years from now people kind of forget. And I always wonder, will there ever be another iconic figure like a Sinatra, an Elvis, a Michael Jackson that might be the end of the line?
You know what, Elvis was lucky in that when he did what he did, it kind of revolutionized everything, and then a bunch of people were around him at the same time kind of doing what he did, but only kind of doing, you know. And so, like you said, and then the Beatles came later and kind of like, he's, you know, re-revolutionized everything. And here's these guys that didn't just perform other people's songs. They wrote their own songs. Mm-hmm. And similarly with the Rolling Stones, kind of had the Beatles and the Rolling Stones were the bad boy version of the Beatles.
Yeah.
But they all, you know, not only did other people's songs like traditional covers, but they wrote their own music. And I think that's the difference between people like the Stones and the Beatles and Elvis, and of course, you know, new artists now too.
Right,
write your own songs.
And that was, they were like the first generation of musicians that could prove that you could play your own songs and write your own songs. Yeah,
and have hits.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
You know, it's funny you mentioned, you know, doing the Danzig Sings Elvis, and this ties into when I saw you last, where we kind of talked about this, was at Lemmy's birthday party.
Oh, yeah.
Reminds me of Lemmy when he did Headcat, where he would go do rockabilly tunes with Slim Jim and just do his own thing. But were you a pretty good friend of Lemmy's?
I wouldn't say I was his best friend.
Yeah.
We knew each other, and we've done shows together, of course, all over the world, in Mexico and Finland, you know, Europe, of course, everywhere. I remember it was 94 or 95. I was in Europe, and I was the host of Viva TV, which at the time was kicking MTV's ass over there. And they gave me a list of people as a guest, and they said, "Who do you want?" And of course, I'm a major Motorhead fan, and we've done shows. And then Lemmy's name was on there. I said, "I want to interview Lemmy." And then I've interviewed him. I had to speak a little German in the beginning, and then introduce him as Lemmy. Lemmy von Motorhead, you know. But yeah, it was great.
Did Misfits and Motorhead kind of start around the same time frame?
I think. I'm not sure. They might have started before us.
Maybe only by a few years, though.
Maybe.
You know, because it's interesting because they were kind of a metal punk band, and you guys were almost a punk metal band. It was like a kind of a mirror image, but just a little bit more on the other side of each way.
We definitely, the stuff I was writing was, I guess, you know, metal punk, because I'm a major Black Sabbath fan, of course. And so punk, of course, you know, changed so many people's lives, and it was kind of weird. There might have been no other band other than Venom that you could put in that category.
Right.
And so I've been a Motorhead fan for ages.
It's funny because, like, you know, you talk about how Motorhead was influencing you. My first taste of Misfits / Danzig was, obviously Metallica, always see Cliff Burton wearing the Danzig shirt
or the
Misfits skull.
Yeah.
He had the Misfits skull. And then, of course, when they did Green Hell and I can't remember, this is escaping me right now.
Last Caress.
And it's, so that again is a perfect example of like this very powerful punk metal. Did that put you back on the map in a bigger way when Metallica's covering your stuff?
I don't know. I think it made people aware of it. But that time, though, I was already doing Samhain.
Right.
And so actually those guys would come into town and we'd hang out and I'd give them a bunch of shirts.
Yeah, James always wore a Sammy shirt. Yeah.
Yeah. And then we'd also, you know, go out maybe one or two nights drinking or whatever and, you know, getting in trouble. We got in trouble, I know, a few times. There was a time in Ireland when we were on tour with them and we got in a lot of trouble. But it's all stuff you think back now on, you laugh, you know. But at the time, we were laughing too. It's just that we didn't know how much trouble we were going to get into the next day.
Right. When you woke up in jail or whatever it was, right?
Yeah. You know, yeah. It was a good time. Yeah. I'd say that.
But it did open the door to a whole new fan base. Like I said, I was one of the people.
It could. Yeah. I think, yeah, by that time. When that record came out, we had already signed with, like, my band Danzig had signed with Rick.
Okay.
Rubin. So, and actually, Rick and myself, my lawyer at the time, and James and a bunch of other people, I think Slash and this other guy, Haggis, we were all hanging out at the Rainbow. And my lawyer was so happy because all his bands were with him at the table. And he's still my lawyer, by the way. And Rick and I had to go back out to the Valley to finish up some stuff on the Danzig record, and James came out and sang on a bunch of songs on the first Danzig record.
I was listening to it on the way over here, and you forget, like, first of all, definitely you have to have a Jim Morrison influence as well. Is that just your natural style?
I think it's not a lot of that, but I think there might be some of it. There's a lot of Elvis, but also people forget that I listen to a ton of blues. Mm-hmm. Like, one of my favorite singers is Howlin' Wolf. And I think maybe there's that connection because I think, if I'm not mistaken, Jim Morrison liked blues. Like, we all have kind of a similar voice. It's like Elvis has a deep voice. I don't have the high, you know, like the Rob Halford or Bruce Dickinson voice. And I wouldn't try to do that. You know what I mean? Because it wouldn't sound good. But, you know, so I have that deeper register voice. And I like a lot of blues, especially, you know, Howlin' Wolf, Willie Dixon, Muddy Waters. You know, I love that stuff, and I sing that stuff all the time. In the 90s, we would do acoustic sets every once in a while, and it was predominantly blues.
Mm.
You know, just two guitars and me screaming, you know, Smokestack Lightning, right, or whatever. Yeah. You know? And so, yeah, I think it comes from that, just having that. When you think about it, there's not a lot of singers with a deeper register voice like that. Mm. So
it's very unique. Like, when you hear your voice, you know it right away. Oh, that's Danzig.
Cool. Thanks.
You know what I mean? Like, it's a pretty cool.
I don't know, because I don't listen to
it. It's my voice, right? Yeah. How instrumental was Rick Rubin in kind of taking you guys even higher?
I think when I first met Rick, because I was talking to lots of different labels at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And when I met with Rick, it was pretty crazy. And at the time, he was a very hands-on producer. I don't know, you know, what he does now.
Mm-hmm.
But he told me stuff that I agreed with. And him and I were kind of on the same wavelength of where I saw myself going and what I wanted to accomplish. And so that's why I ended up signing with Rick. And I think it worked really good in the beginning.
What was the mindset that you wanted to do?
I said, look, I want, you know, my records to be like all the records that I like, where it's like people don't listen to them just for a year. I want people listening to my stuff and coming back to it for like 10, 20, 30 years. I want to be like, you know, an artist that makes a difference and that people are inspired by.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that's what I want. He goes, that's exactly as I see you. That's what I see you doing, like being an album artist.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a hit record, great. If you don't, you go back tour and then you come back home, you do another record and go back out. And you're not doing it just to do hits. You're just going to make the greatest record you can. Kind of like AC/DC and Black Sabbath and all these other
longevity
bands.
Longevity.
And like a longevity kind of thing. And I said, that's exactly how I see what I, you know, myself doing.
But yet here you stumble onto Mother, which becomes a generational hit. Like, I was listening to today, and just remember, like, when I was living in Knoxville, Tennessee at the time, which is another story, which I'll tell you in a second. But that song was on MTV like every 5 minutes. It was massive song.
They didn't really want to play it.
Really?
No, they, when they first came out, they banned us Because,
why?
Because the video had, like,
you had
a
your
sacrifice
shirt off?
And some crazy stuff. And Rick gave them a wrong video by accident, and they showed it on TV. And then they hated us. They hated Rick. They hated Slayer. They Rick had at the time. Rick had us, Slayer, Dice Clay, and somebody else. And they hated all of us. So what happened was, at the time, MTV had a competitor called the Video Music Box. You know, you could call up, and for a dollar or 50 cents, they would play your track. And
okay.
My mother was exploding there and on, you know, FM radio all over the country, like 6 years after it was released, because we put out a Thrall record, which was live. And it's just people going crazy.
Yeah.
And so we came back from tour, and we had a hit.
A huge hit that just blew up.
And so MTV had to play it, is my story. Is like, and they didn't want to play it, but they had to play it because everybody else was playing it.
Yeah. And then they kind of, because it's such a big, big song. To the point where I used to be obsessed with Guitar Hero. Uh-huh. And I used to play Mother all the time. I could play the best Guitar Hero solo for that tune.
That's awesome.
I went to Cincinnati. I was living in Knoxville, and I went to see Metallica, Danzig, and Suicidal, I believe it was.
Yep, I remember.
And Rick was there, and unbeknownst to me, he was the secret investor to the wrestling company that I was working for.
That's Smoky Mountain Wrestling.
Smoky Mountain Wrestling, yeah.
Rick and used to send me tapes of that on the road.
So, because I met you there, and I was, because you actually, I've watched Smoky. I was like, I couldn't believe that you knew who I was. Not that you knew who I was, but I've seen you on Smoky Mountain Wrestling. He's like, wow, that's cool, man. So were you one of those guys that would be on the bus watching VHS tapes of wrestling?
Yeah, of course. It's so funny. I was just telling this to Cherie before. I think I told you already, I wanted to be a wrestler.
Really?
Yeah, but I didn't think I was big enough. And then I met some wrestlers, and I'm like, I could have been a wrestler. But it all worked out pretty good for
me. Yeah, so, I think you did okay in the end, right?
But, you know,
where did you grow up?
Back east.
Okay, in Jersey?
Jersey, New York, and Boston. Also, my mom's relatives were all from Boston.
So were you watching, like, WWF?
WWF, yeah. But also, we got Florida Championship Wrestling, and I got Mexican wrestling on the Mexican stations, too. You know? So I watched that, and we had AWA, too.
That's what I grew up on.
The Vern Gagne.
Yeah, so I grew up on. I'm from Winnipeg, so that's what.
Yeah, but, yeah, so, I mean, in high school, I used to wrestle, and then I saw my friend's arm snap when he fell in a wrong hold, and it was in a metal pins in three spots.
Ooh, yeah.
I was like, you know what? I think I'm going to go back to my band.
But that was always part of your gimmick, too. You always had, like, the big chest, the big arms.
That comes from other stuff. And so, it did turn out okay for me, so I guess it's better that I wasn't. I get the same amount of injuries as you guys still have.
But it was funny too, though, because like you said, in rock and roll, most guys are skinny and they're cracked out or whatever. But you always looked really big, because if you have any muscle at all in rock and roll, you look like a giant.
Yeah.
You know, it was you and the guitar player from Alice Cooper. Remember that guy, Kane Roberts?
Oh, I remember him. I wasn't that big. It just, you know, I think it was just, I at the time, I wanted to take my body and my mind to, like, this other spot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I just did, you know?
Did you, who were some of your favorite wrestlers when you were growing up, getting influenced by them?
My favorite all-time wrestler is Freddie Blassie.
Nice.
And then I like Superstar Billy Graham. And you're not going to be in my top five.
But I actually,
when you did come to the WWE and you did the whole Raw's Jericho, that was incredible.
Oh, cool.
And I think it took you from here to just...
Well...
It's where you should have been.
Well, it's the same kind of similar to what you're saying when you went to go with Rick Rubin. You go from a certain level to through the roof because of the push that you're getting and the machine that's behind you.
You still got to go on the road and do it. You know what I'm talking about.
Of course.
You got to pay your dues.
Of course.
So we played a lot of shitholes on those first two records. And a lot of other – but, like, you know, I'm sure you had to do the same.
Always.
I think everyone was waiting, because I have tons of friends who are wrestlers, you know, in other bands and just friends in general. And when you came to the WWF and did that first Raw's Jericho, was – it was electric.
Yeah,
it was
cool.
I love wrestling still. So
do you still watch?
Yeah, when something cool happens, I'm so excited, because it's, you know, I don't watch football. I hate football. I hate baseball. I hate all that crap. I like watching wrestling because it's like this crazy spectacle.
Yeah, alternate soap opera universe.
Kind of, but still, it's very physical and violent, and you know that's the kind of stuff I like. You know, like I love the original movie Rollerball, because it's just so crazy and violent, and just, you know, and that for me, wrestling, you know, add in all the entertainment value and the craziness and the storylines, it's just. It's my thing.
Have you seen, like, what are some of the other, like, electric moments that you can recall from wrestling? Is there other things that stand out for you?
Let's see. There's so many other wrestlers that I love, but I used to like Macho Man when he first broke in and was, like, the anti-hero. Or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, he was supposed to be a bad guy, but people liked him, so.
Yeah.
I still call him bad guys. I don't use all the, I don't use all the internet terms, so.
Me neither.
Yeah. So, but, yeah, but there's so many great characters, you know, mm-hmm. in wrestling that, you know, I think one of my new favorites is the Wyatt family. It's like this Cape Fear Charles Manson family mm-hmm. or something. It's pretty cool.
They actually base that a little bit on Cape Fear, but also on House of 1,000 Corpses.
Oh, cool. Rob.
The family. Yeah, Rob, right?
Oh,
yeah. Are you a big horror movie fan?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
So what kind of stuff do you like from...
I like Hills Have Eyes, the original.
Yeah.
I like so much horror stuff. It's, you know, but then there's stuff I hate too, like some of the new, like, you know, a movie will be a hit and then they'll make 18 movies like it.
Right.
You know, I hate that shit.
Hollywood goes through those phases where they'll put out, you know, okay, here's the creepy doll movie, and then there'll be 20 other creepy doll movies. Yeah. So, like, you know, it's like for a while it was like Conjuring not Insurgent, whatever it's called, Insidious, and a bunch of movies all similar within the same year or two.
I think they're on Insidious 8 now, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. Right? And a couple of years before, there was Saw, and Saw 2, and Saw 3, and Saw 4, and Saw 8, and all those type of
Actually,
things.
Actually, the stuff I'm into now is, like, I think there's some great stuff on TV now.
Oh.
I watch Bates Motel. I like the first two seasons of America Horror Story. I like the Lizzie Borden Chronicles, but I also like America Unearthed, where they, you know, trace the Templars and all the other stuff, and the history you know isn't really the history you know. This is all stuff I've been into for decades.
So explain that a little bit. Like, we're talking about America, like the Templars.
Okay, so America Unearthed is basically the show, and I want to say it's based on this old book I got back in the late 80s mid-80s called America B.C.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more than that, though. But basically it's saying, like, you know, you think that these people discovered America, but they didn't discover America. And this is, you know, this and this is this. And look at this and look at all this, you know, stuff. And you're just like, whoa.
Hmm. You know? So who are they saying discovered America?
Well, of course, they're showing you, like, Iberian trade routes, and, you know, they're showing you Celtic graveyards in America, and they're showing you all this other crazy stuff. And, like, this guy who has the show America Unearthed is showing you a Templar burial tomb in Arizona. And then they're showing you Mexican pyramids in Minnesota and Wisconsin. And that they're saying that, you know, Aztlan, the Mexican homeland, is actually up north. It's not.
You're kidding me.
Down. And then they're showing you proof that when, you know, the Aztec Empire was under invasion, they sent the gold back up north, Montezuma's gold, I guess, and they can't find it now. And just crazy stuff like that. And that the Templars came over and landed in Nova Scotia, which everybody knows. And,
yeah.
And then you have government trying to, like, cover it up and say no. And
it's Christopher Columbus and the Pilgrims.
Yeah, and then they start you know what a disinformation campaign is, right?
Well, explain.
Disinformation is where you put out false information as if it's real.
Real.
Yeah, and then people believe it.
Right, which would seem like a government trick for many things.
For centuries.
Yeah.
So, you know, and this is the kind of thing that, you know, it's so easy to do disinformation campaigns now on the internet. Because there's no, you know, it's like the Wild West.
Well, all it takes is two or three, you know, tweets or Facebook posts or articles, and people start believing it as if it's fact.
Exactly.
You know, and that's the world we live in.
That's how they used to do disinformation campaigns with media. So a lot of different, you know, we're going to get into crazy government stuff. But basically it just...
Which I love, by the way.
love a lot of the stuff I read. So basically a lot of different people in government control a lot of the media. So it's so easy, to even before the internet, to put out a disinformation campaign. Mm-hmm. And the government does it all the time. When they don't want you to know something, they'll just put something out there, and then, you know, it's supposed to shut everybody up. Mm. Yeah, and that's the way it goes.
Yeah, I've had a lot of conspiracy theorists on the show saying that basically,
oh, cool.
If you go into like the early 1900s, like the Rockefellers and all these types, they had so much money and were manipulating the entire banking system that whatever they said basically goes.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you have people who run all the newspapers in the country.
Right, yeah.
The Hearst and, you know.
Yeah, the Hearst family.
Yeah, and so they can do whatever they want because they own all the newspapers.
Yeah.
You know? And so, there's a lot of good books that you can get on that stuff. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, the Bilderbergs.
What's the Bilderbergs?
The Bilderbergs is a group that's been around for a long time. A lot of people, I guess maybe in their early stages, people would call it the New World Order or whatever, or the Illuminati before that.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, it's a group that wants to control everything that goes on in the world that we know.
I love that stuff, man. You know what I mean?
But you should get the Bilderberg group. Then there's another Bilderberg conspiracy book, but there's another good book called the Committee of 300, the Conspirators' Hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
That's really good. Because it talks about the Delanos and the Roosevelts. And,
okay.
And the Chinese opium trade and all that kind of crazy stuff and ties it all in. And,
I mean, well, like you said, there's so much more things that we don't really know. And that's kind of the way that people like it.
I think there's people that want to know, and then there's other people like, I don't care. I don't, because I've always said this before, with knowledge comes responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And some people don't want to, you know.
Don't want to get involved.
Yeah.
Don't want to do anything about it.
Just want to do the thing.
Yeah.
And that's cool too. Actually, you know, that's your prerogative, you know.
I was thinking about that even today when I parked out front of the street and that you had turned the alarm on your car. I'm like, if someone breaks in the car and the alarm's going off, no one's going to do anything. You know, someone's going to walk by and go, hey, you know.
Not in L.A.
Yeah, not in L.A. I was going to ask you a question. What is your last name, Danzig? What national?
It's German, but there's a big dispute about it being German. So we'll just say it's German.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm going to German. Yeah. So where are some of the biggest countries that you tour in where Danzig has a big value and big name?
States.
Mm-hmm.
But Europe, of course. You know, Scandinavia, Germany.
It's amazing, though, like pretty much a worldwide, you know.
Yeah, we've been touring Europe and Scandinavia, you know, forever.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like from the beginning. Some of the mother video actually is shot at festivals and at shows in Europe. It's not just shot at the Irvine show. It's shot also, I took the camera crew for about a week over to Europe and England, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, I mean, like, because you kind of pioneered like this style, like we talked about earlier. Plus, you have a lot of different interests with horror movies and stuff, and also comic books too, mm-hmm. with the Verotic series, which is really cool stuff.
It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. That's been going on for years.
Yeah, we started. I decided I was going to do it around 93, 94, and then we put out our first books at the tail end of 94, and we're still going.
So, are you writing? You write them?
Yeah, I write all the stuff now. Before, we used to use other people. Now I'm writing all of it now. So
you have a lot of similarities to me in that it's not just about one thing. It's about doing a bunch of different things under the brand name of Danzig.
Mm-hmm.
I it's my podcast or with Wrestling with Fozzie and all the different things that I do. It's so important to spread your wings that way and not be afraid to try different things.
You know what? For me, it's all about still like the art aspect of it also. So like music and writing songs and performing and everything. I still love it, you know.
Creating.
Doing and creating, like you said.
Right.
And so, you know, there's some people that just want to be in a band, that's it, and that's great. But I'm, you know, and maybe you're the same way, you want to do other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You want to experiment and try different stuff, and there's maybe stuff that you're interested in, you want to do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and I remember when I started the comic company, I was like, nobody was doing it. And, you know, I'm a comic fan of not just United States comics, but Japanese, European. And their stuff is everywhere from little kid stuff to crazy adult stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, why don't we have it here? And I'm talking to all the fans at the end of the night, and 80 to 90% of them are comic fans. And they're asking me about this comic and that comic. And I'm like, somebody should do a cool company. And I'm like, sitting back finally, and I always wanted to do it. And I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to do it.
It's, yeah, it's you the know? Timing's right.
And, you know, I know that there's at least a certain portion of people out there who want to see this kind of stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
you know, and that, you know, and we don't have any superheroes. You know, I've said it many times. There's nobody in spandex running around saving the world. You know, we don't have any of that. We just have crazy characters killing each other and going crazy.
When I was a kid growing up in the 80s, I discovered the EC comics.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, which was before the comic code was invented.
Yeah.
Which, if you go back and look at it, it's just these horrible things happening, and they're comics.
But there's that, worse comics than EC comics
from back in that time frame.
Oh yeah, there's see, because I'm also a comic fan.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's pre-code horror comics that are just crazy, where just like the covers are just severed heads, and
someone taking a bite of a severed head like it's an apple or something.
Someone about to stick a red hot poker in someone's eyeball, and that's all the cover is. It's a big eyeball and a poker getting ready to go, with fire on the end of it, getting ready to go in the eyeball. I mean, just crazy stuff.
Right.
And you're just going, you know, it's not bothering me, but I guess maybe some parent might see her kid looking at this, you know, comic with a poker getting ready to stick in someone's eye and go like,
yeah,
but not me. I'm
right.
Not that person. I'm like, yeah, this is cool. That's that's the comic. I don't want to read Superman. I want to read that.
Yeah, know? Yeah.
That's me.
Because there's also these magazines I used to buy called Creepy Magazines.
Creepy,
which
eerie,
was eerie, and they were black and white horror comics.
Yeah.
Like just newsprint type of stuff.
Yeah, those were cool. See, that's like the stuff I liked. And then at that time, I was discovering underground comics. And a lot of the really, really good artists at like DC and Marvel didn't want to work there, and they started working for those companies, like Bernie Wrightson and all those guys.
Yeah, the famous guys. Yeah,
Frazetta had already moved on to, you know, paperback covers and getting more money than everybody else. So, yeah, but all those guys, that's one of the reasons I used Kaluta for the Black Aria record, because I love his stuff.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, and then I know the second Black Aria, I used Bill Sienkiewicz.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know the new Anthrax, they use Alex Ross.
Yeah.
So they you know, they
see, everybody likes, you know, their favorite artist. And
yeah.
You can get in that position where you can actually hire these people to do your cover. Like Bisley, I've been working with him now since 92 is when I had him do the Thrall cover.
Okay.
And we actually filmed it with my crew that was over there filming the festivals and everything. And I've been working with him since 1992. We still work together. We're working on a new book again, another lyric book.
Is there does Verotic come out every month, or like just
no.
when you want to put them out? Or
what happened was it started becoming everything I didn't want it to be, like the other companies. We started using artists and writers I didn't want to use just because we had to put out a book every month or every other month. And I just finally, I just put the brakes on it. I saw one of the books we did and I didn't like it at all. And I was like, this is stopping right now. We're only going to put out books when we have something to say.
Is there still a comics code now? Or is that kind of gone?
That's gone.
So that was just kind of in the 70s and 80s or something?
I think it was in the, it was starting probably around 53. Right?
Right, yeah.
Maybe 54, some like right around there. And then it lasted until the 80s, I think. But
yeah,
I think towards
then.
The 80s, the indie comic scene started happening.
Right.
And then I think towards the end of the 90s, it was gone.
Well, because back at that time, too, when the code was there basically was just Marvel and DC. That was it. There was maybe a few, like Gold Key or whatever, some other ancillary ones. But there really wasn't a lot of options in that time frame.
Yeah, I think that, you know, Archie Comics was having no problems with the code. They probably weren't even checking the Archie books. They were just like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, let those through.
But I think that actually in the 60s and 70s and even in the early 80s, I think they still had to send the book to the code to be approved.
Mm.
How crazy is that?
Yeah, right?
If we had to send the Verotic books to a code, it would be like 4F, no.
Yeah, 4, right.
Yeah. It was just like, here's it's a 24-page book. You have to take out 24 pages.
Yeah. So do you still do, how much touring do you still do on a yearly basis?
Well, now I'm done.
Oh, you're not touring anymore?
No.
I heard you say that earlier. I wasn't sure if I heard it right.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to tour anymore. I stopped touring back around 2005.
Really? Long ago?
And then the manager said, well, what if we just do like a regional tour here on the West Coast and you fly home all the time? Because my problem isn't being on stage. It's the bouncing around on the bus and not being near my stuff and being able to do, you know, we're talking about the creating and all that other stuff and doing all this other stuff I want to do. and you can't really do it on the road. So I said, okay, we'll try it. Let's go out for 2, maybe 3 weeks, and I'll fly home every couple of days. And that worked. And so then they said, okay, well, why don't we try something a little more, like go out to the Midwest and back, and you fly home, you know, same thing, 2, 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I tried that, and that worked. So then I think it was around 2008. They said, okay, well, let's try the whole country, and you fly home all the time. And then that worked. So I said, okay, I can do this if we can do it that way. So then when it came time to tour, I would do that. Mm-hmm. This last tour, it didn't work that way, and I wasn't able to fly home as much as I wanted to just because of routing. And, mm-hmm. you know, I won't take flights that stop places. I want to direct.
You want direct all
yeah,
the way.
I don't
yeah.
want to get stuck in, you
Sheboygan.
Know. Exactly. I don't even know where that is.
Wisconsin.
Okay.
Nothing is the fine people of Sheboygan.
But I don't want to get stuck there.
Yeah.
So it didn't work out that well. And I did 2 runs in the States on this last thing like that. And I just said, that's it. I'm done. You know, so I'm not going to stop performing. I'm just not going to tour anymore. Maybe I'll fly here, do a show, and then fly home.
Gotcha.
Or I'll do local shows here in, you know, Southern California or Northern California, whatever. But it's not going to be
make it more of an event type thing.
Yeah, I'm just not going to do that thing. And maybe, you know, 3 or 4 years from now, I don't know, revisit it if I can fly home, you know, or maybe just do regionally kind of thing. And, you know,
it's hard to be on the road for 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks at a time.
Yeah, when you're younger, you know, you don't care. But
right.
as you get older, your priorities change and things are different. And, you know, like we were talking about before, you're doing lots of different stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want to be able to still do all that different stuff now, and it's not as important, you know.
Right.
You want to, if you can do all the things you want to do, then of course you're going to want to do it. But if you can't,
do you miss the buzz of being on stage, the live element of it?
There's nothing like, and you know it, you know, there's nothing like being on stage and sending out that energy and getting it back from them, because then it just amplifies and you turn it out into something even more powerful, and then they send it back and you send it back, and it's pretty intense. It's cool, you know, because we're not doing a Tom Petty show. We're doing, you know, we're doing a crazy, you know, sometimes our pit is insane, you know,
right.
And, you know, and then you got everybody else on the sides that's not in the pit going out of their minds.
Mm-hmm.
To me, I'm helping them and they're helping me, you know, I'm forgetting about all my crap I have to deal with, and hopefully they're doing this experience and forgetting about all their crap too, and they can leave that concert just like, wow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Man, that was great.
Yeah.
You know, exhausted, whatever, you know, emotionally, physically, whatever, but they had a great time, an experience. I don't want to just do a concert. I want people to have a great experience, something that they can't get anywhere else. That's what I look for when I go to a concert.
Sure.
I want to be knocked off my socks.
Have you ever seen a concert? Like, what's your favorite concert that you've seen either when you were a kid or now? Has there been bands that do that to you?
I still, when you see Slayer and you hear those. It never gets old.
Yeah. You know, I went to, we played Carolina Rebellion last year, whatever it was, and I went and stood, not in the pit, but right at the front of the stage, like resting my, you know, and that band is so powerful. Yeah. And you not forget, but you quote unquote forget until you see it again. Like you said, it's just so powerful, man. Nobody does that like
I like distinctive bands. And I think that's one of the things that Rick, when we signed with him, he was telling me, he goes, I don't want like middle of the road bands. He goes, I want bands like you. I want like Slayer. I want an artist that has something to say. And I want people to react either negatively or positively to it. And I was like, that's exactly what I don't want anyone middle of the road about me. I want people to either love me or hate me.
Yeah.
You know,
which is
mean?
Great. That's the way it should
that's
be.
That's what I want. I want that extreme reaction. I want them to just like be like, and you know, and that's one of the things that Rick and I agreed on. It was like, you know, you're going to be an artist, you have to have a statement, you have to be saying something.
Right.
Yeah.
You want to have that, like I said, that distinct, unique quality where people just know that's Danzig.
Or whatever band.
Or whoever it may be.
You're like when we were talking about Motorhead before, as soon as you hear Lemmy's voice, you know it's Motorhead. But also you hear that bass. It's like a guitar-y kind of bass.
Right.
You know? And it's like he's pounding on the thing.
Yeah.
Which is one of the things I love about Motorhead, because that's how I play guitar. I pound on the thing.
Which is so, I mean, that his rig was called Murder One. Mm-hmm. And like you said, just to see, like obviously since he passed away, and you know, when musicians pass away, I mean, it always sucks for friends, but Lemmy was a friend too. So I was watching a lot of his stuff and just remembering just not just as a singer, as a personality, as the drinking whiskey, but just as a bass player. He's a great player, man.
Yeah.
You know, and that Murder One, that just shooting out the distortion of it, the power. Well,
that's another, like, you know, you're talking about Slayer when you hear the riff, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But when you hear Ace of Spades,
you know it.
You know.
Yeah.
You know the song. You
yeah,
know what
exactly.
that is. And then you hear Lemmy's voice and you know you're hearing something
yeah.
pretty unique.
And that's the saddest thing. I mean, we had Lemmy and then Bowie and then Glenn Frey all pass away in a short period of time. Not only are you losing the guy, the legendary guy, but the music, like, it will never be played again live by those guys. And like Motorhead, we lost Motorhead and Lemmy. That to me is like hard to envision that.
Yes, with Bowie, I was lucky enough to see some of the earlier Bowie
really?
Things. Yeah, I didn't get to see Ziggy. That was a little before.
Yeah, a little before your time. Yeah,
but I got to see the Diamond Dogs and the David Live stuff at Radio City. I actually took pictures at Radio City because I was going to New York Institute of Photography.
No kidding.
In Manhattan, yeah.
So you're in the photo pit taking pictures.
Yeah, I would bullshit my way with my camera all the time. Yeah, impressed. Where's your passport? My guy's got it. I don't know.
Because yeah. As you know, the secret to being somewhere is just acting like you're supposed to be there.
Yeah.
As long as you
it's
act
the
like
vibe.
It. Yeah.
And so I would do that. And I learned that in school. They just like bullshit your way up there and get whatever you're going to do. You know. And I was able to take lots of pictures of lots of bands back then. I have Sid on stage at Maxis Kansas City. I have Lou Reed, God, the Cramps backstage at CBGB's, Richard Hell hanging out at CBGB's. I mean, just like name some bands. I got Iggy on stage with Bowie playing keyboard.
No kidding.
Yeah, for the Idiot Tour.
Yeah, because they worked together quite a bit.
Yeah, well, he helped do the Idiot record, and then he came out on that tour as a keyboard player and backup singer.
There was such a scene in New York
yeah.
in the 70s at that time frame.
I got Hunter and Ronson on stage, you know. I think my manager's been talking. I think I'm going to do a photo book. I'm not sure of all my old photos. From
Why not,
time.
Right?
Yeah, I guess. I got to find all the stuff and everything. But yeah,
find a cardboard box somewhere.
Somewhere, yeah. But yeah, so... I'm pretty sure.
I just watched this. I was walking around on Netflix, and I just saw this random Blondie documentary, Blondie in New York. And it was like this, you know, 70s Blondie and making one of the records or whatever. And just all of the vibe in the scene, and just there was so much different kind of, you know, it was punk, but it was disco, but it was this, but it was that. It was just a great vibe. It must have been cool to grow up at that time.
In the beginning, it was all kind of lumped in. It was kind of one thing,
yeah.
Punk new wave, and then it kind of punk became more violent and mm-hmm. more angry, and new wave became more acceptable and fashionable.
Yeah.
Even though there was still fashion with punk, but it wasn't the same kind as. You know, and that's when it's kind of schismed, and then it, you know, hardcore happened.
So what was your guys' mindset when you first started the Misfits? What were you trying to get at?
I just wanted to destroy the world. I think my mindset was like a lot of everybody else who was into punk. We just hated all the crappy bands putting out records that sucked and like 20-minute leads and drum solos. And it's like, you know,
yeah.
It was, you know, brought it back to being about the song.
Mm-hmm.
Like, being able to play it like, you know, some artiste, you know, soloist or whatever. Just
prog rock. Yeah.
Yeah, it was the vibe.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people still don't get that about punk, that it was more about the vibe, the thing that made punk. Like, you can copy a punk song and it sounds like a punk song, but it kind of isn't a punk song.
Mm-hmm.
You got to have that reason.
Well, the thing that people demean punk about, couldn't even play their instruments. Well, that was half of it. It was just the attitude of just being like, kill the world, like you said.
Yeah, well, but then if you listen to early rock and roll, they said the same thing about them people. They said, oh, they can't play their instruments. They're terrible.
And
we were talking about Elvis before, but man, when I was doing this Elvis record, trying to sing some of those songs, his range was incredible. I would like to see some of those other people do those Elvis songs.
And not just range, but the feel. Like if you listen to In the Ghetto, for example, like he sings that like so emotional, his vibrato and the notes that he chooses. You see this scene that he's setting, and that's part of it too.
This is the crazy thing. I remember, actually, Rick and I were talking about it. You know, I'm like doing vocal after vocal, and I go, man, my throat's getting, you know, messed up. He's like, Elvis used to do 92 takes of each song, and he would do like 5 songs a day. I'm like, I'm not Elvis.
Yeah, this ain't 1955, yeah, dude.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what Pro Tools and editing. And
but it tells you exactly, like, here's this guy, and, you know, he's doing all these takes, and each vocal is probably getting better, not, you know, worse. Mm-hmm. And it's just like,
yeah,
you know, you start thinking about it and going, wow, man.
Well, it's the same as the Beatles when you know, they did the first record, like, in, I think it was in 12 hours, the Please Please Me record, in 12 hours, the whole record. But they'd also been singing, you know, 14 hours a night in Germany,
yeah,
you know, on pills and drinking and on speed. So I'm sure they had it locked in at that point.
I don't know about any of that stuff. But,
someone told me that's what happens.
It could be. Germany, I think they were playing in the Reeperbahn, right?
That's right.
I remember we were playing early on in Danzig's career. We were playing the same club that the Beatles played in, the Reeperbahn in Hamburg.
Was it the Star Club or the Kaiser Keller?
I forget.
Yeah.
They actually gave us the tour and everything.
Yeah,
it was pretty funny.
It's funny because I was in Germany in 93. I did a 6-week wrestling tour there, but you wrestle the same arena, same tent every night. And I went to the Kaiser Keller, and you walk in, it's like, this place sucks.
Yeah, it's a shithole.
It stinks of like beer, and it's just, This is it, you know.
It's pretty funny because when we played there, our drummer passed out because there was no air. They passed the place so
it's downstairs.
Tight. Hot. It was just like it was anyway.
But that's kind of like you said, the beauty of like these legendary places that really kind of like the ECW Arena.
Yeah,
you know, the famous ECW Arena that it's basically is a bingo hall, and there was no air conditioning in it or heat in the winter, so it was a shithole. But it had that vibe, you know.
But you know what? If you were playing the two shitholes under that, and you get to that shithole at your at that stage in your career, you're like, hey, this
it's
is
a
great.
Kingdom.
Yeah.
Did you guys, I forgot what I was going to say, when you're talking about CBGB's, famous places, you used to hang out there?
I used to hang out there, but later on I didn't hang out there because the Misfits, like I would book the band.
Oh, really?
We kept on getting tryouts there. And I'm like, what do you mean tryout? If you like this the first time, yeah, well, you got to keep coming and doing tryouts. And
really, even if you played there, you'd have to go back? And
you didn't get paid, you didn't get billing.
Okay.
And so I started getting frustrated, and I'm like, when are we getting our own show? And, you know, and like, well, we're going to have you do play with another one of our terrible bands. And, you know, you'll bring all your people, they don't bring anybody, and you don't get paid.
Yeah.
And finally, I'd had enough, and I knew the people that that were booking Max's at the time. Max's Kansas City. It was a famous venue.
Another famous venue. Yeah.
New York Dolls. I think this is, you know, Aaron
Blondie.
Smith.
Yeah.
Yeah. Always. Well, Blondie was a CBGB.
Okay. So you're either one or the other.
But what happened was Max's was making a big push to get, you know, bands. And I knew the booking agents there, and I was telling them my problem. They're like, why don't you come here? We'll make you a house band. We'll give you billing, and we'll pay you, and we'll give you a bar tab. And we were drinkers at the time. I was like, okay, that sounds great. You know, this is way better. You know, and we, you know, Misfits made it out of Maxis. We did not, and it just was like, and before I knew it, we were playing Irving Plaza, Hurrah, you know, and then on and upward.
Getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
Were you doing the white paint in at that time too with Misfits?
The first Irving Plaza, I did the other guys, Jerry was the only one who put on the the eyes. But on the first Halloween show, yeah, I did the full skull face and this, you know, I was wearing a skull shirt by that time and the gloves. And then I think I did it a couple more times and then stopped doing it. And then the music started getting more thrashy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, and it started changing really.
Like, because you left the Misfits in like 84, 83, 85?
82, And I think I did one final show in 83. The band broke up, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like I, you know, I, and I had moved on to doing the Sam Hain thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Does it blow your mind, where fans, and God bless them, where they still say, are you ever going to go back to the Misfits?
Really, my mindset is like, you know, I'm glad you like the old stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, you like it better than whatever, you know. You know, I'm so into doing what I'm doing right now, you know.
For the last 35 years.
Yeah.
You know.
So the success I've had with Danzig is just, you know, crazy. And, you know.
Huge.
It's a lot of work, you know, and a lot of people besides myself to thank, like Rick and different people who are involved, you know, with the labels and, mm-hmm. you know, booking agents who took a chance on us and, you know, and what I was doing, you know. And so, you know, it's just been crazy. I couldn't have asked for, you know.
It's just a little bit of a stroke of luck too when you think, you know, like you just never know right place, right time.
Work.
Oh, sure it is. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Luck is maybe part of it, but it's a lot of hard work. Once you get in there, they're not just going to hand it to you. You've got to, you know, and it's probably like that in wrestling.
Well, absolutely.
You know, they give you the ball, but you got to run with it. If you can't run with that ball, you ain't going anywhere.
And that's not just for the first 5 years or 10 years. That's up until this moment that we're sitting here right now.
Yeah.
You know, you got to be hustling and constantly expanding your horizons.
Yeah, you're as good as your last record and your last tour.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah. Absolutely, right?
Yeah.
So what do you want to do then over the next few years? You mentioned you're not touring anymore. Will you still do, like, I see you having, like, an annual Halloween gig, like, at Universal Theater or something.
Sheree and I were just talking about that. It's, like, it was my favorite place to play, and it's gone. We did the last show there.
Oh, they took it down?
Yeah, it's torn down. So we did the last rock show, and then there was a comedy show the night after. But when we were there, you know, doing sound checks and everything, all the demolition trucks were in the back.
Yeah.
The tour buses. And so I was like, oh, man, this is my favorite place to play. We did a shirt just for that night, and it had all the dates Danzig played Universal.
Like, oh, wow.
7 or 8 shows there.
Wow.
Since 92 to now, seven or eight, you know. And we've played other places like Irvine or whatever.
Sure, of course.
But this, for me, it was my favorite place. A nice size stage, pit in the front if you want to go crazy, seats going up like this so it's not a bad seat in the house. Sounded great, and it's gone.
Yeah.
You know, and we put Sheree on the bill, and she'd always wanted to play there and never had the opportunity. It was what made her... she saw Bowie there on the Diamond Dogs tour, and it's what made her decide she wanted to be a singer.
Really?
Yeah, and she was like...
At the Universal Theater.
Yeah, and so I was like, how would you like to come and do this show? And she was like, oh, no, you're kidding me. I've always wanted to play there, and it was great, man. She did a great job.
Were you a Runaways fan?
Yeah, I remember seeing them at CBGB's.
That's great,
on the
man.
Old stage. Yeah.
I love how you're such a fan. So that's cool that you're working with her then.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Though when I originally wanted to do a duet on the record for the song, all the managers were like, oh, you got to get this hip person or that hip person. And I wanted somebody with more, like, history, legacy, and, like, some more, like, kind of cred, not just, like, the hip flavor of the month, you know, girl. And I was like, what about Sheree Curry? And they were like, what? And I'm like, yeah, what about Sheree? She's great. Like, I don't know. I'm like... Trust me. And she did an incredible job. And, she's a legend.
Especially. Looks like an OG. Yeah, like totally.
Yeah.
It's funny because we did the Kiss Cruise this year and Lita Ford was on it. And just watching her play, it's like, this chick has been doing this for 40 years and she's still kicking ass.
Yeah.
And then I went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame 2 years ago when they had Joan Jett singing with Nirvana. And you think that's kind of a weird mix. But she was the perfect fit. Like all three of them. You know, they got that cred and that spirit.
When you think about it, the Runaways were the first real all-girl band.
Right, yeah.
There were girl bands before, but they were kind of like...
manufactured.
Yeah, I don't know if they played their instruments or whatever. You know, they might have been singers, but they were, I think... I don't know if I... Am I wrong? But
I don't even know if there was any that even... pretended, like, besides like the Partridge Family or whatever, but I think the Runaways were definitely
all girl.
No,
but Cassidy was
definitely the first all girl band.
Yeah,
you know, I can't think of any other ones.
And playing like heavier music, heavier rock and roll.
Yeah, kick-ass tunes,
right? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. A couple last questions, Glenn. What's your favorite horror movie, if you have to choose?
Oh, I don't know if it's a horror movie, but my favorite movie, I don't know if it's considered a horror movie, but I love Jean Cocteau's Beauty and the Beast.
Really?
Yeah, it's just the craziest, like...
Interesting
it's
call.
Impressionistic, but it's also really cool. The cinematography's great. I mean, every time he kills an animal or something, and he's the beast, his hands are smoking, and there's blood all over him. And I mean, when they're walking down the hallway, there's these arms holding these candles, and they light as they walk by each one. And they sit at the table, and you'll see the furnace, and there's these faces that they've molded real actors into the furnace, and then all of a sudden they'll go, and smoke blows out of their mouth. They sit down at the table, and you'll see an arm holding a goblet, and it just starts pouring stuff into there. It's pretty creative.
What year is that from?
Oh,
is it fairly old?
I think it's the mid to late 30s.
I'm surprised that you've never made a movie.
I'm about to. I've been trying, and so it's, you know how it is in Hollywood.
Yeah.
I directed a lot of the Danzig videos, and then also I've directed a lot of the four-camera shoots for the live shows and things like that. Mm-hmm. Put together all the home videos and tied them all together with the stuff that goes in between everything. And so hopefully this year it's going to...
Yeah, because I think you remind me a lot of Rob Zombie. A lot of similarities between the two guys.
Rob is a really cool guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. We actually just did a show together in Vegas.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he would come out on some of our shows. I remember a long time I would come out and sing with him, but we both got together at the end of the night, and Tommy, you know, my guitar player, Tommy Victor.
Yeah.
Him and I went out, and we played a bunch of songs with Rob and John Five and the rest of the band.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. So you did a Danzig gig and then a Zombie gig and then came out together.
We came out at the end. Yeah,
what songs did you do at the end?
Oh, I think we did...
Like some covers?
We did Vampira, Misfit Song Vampira, and we did something else. I forget right now. Was it Skulls? Okay. So it might have been. I forget what it was.
I saw you actually at the Metallica 30 doing Die Die My Darling with them.
Oh, yeah. We did Die Die, and I think we did Green Hell.
Yeah. Two, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that was great when they called me out.
I still think that's one of the most amazing feats that any band has ever done, playing those 80 songs in four nights or whatever it was. Did you guys rehearse that or...?
I flew up that afternoon and just, you know, but we'd done it like, you talked about that tour, the Metallica Danzig and Suicidal tour. Mm-hmm. A couple times on those shows, I came out and sang some stuff with them. I remember actually they came to town once. It was during Samhain. I think it was when Samhain was turning into Danzig again. Mm-hmm. We would go into rehearsal places in New York and just jam on crap together and just beat up equipment, smash it, and play our songs. And, it was much different then. But, yeah, it was nice going up and seeing them all again.
It was a cool vibe.
It was very cool. Also, Jerry Cantrell was on. And,
yeah. Everybody was there.
Yeah.
Biff from Saxon was there, and Halford was there, and Ozzy and Geezer were there. And
yeah.
It was cool.
Jerry Cantrell happens to be one of my favorite guitar players.
Oh, okay.
And singers, too. He's a great singer.
Totally, yeah. So, he always sang the doubles on all those Alice in Chains records.
Yeah, live, too.
Yeah.
But they did Nothing Else Matters that night, kind of acoustic.
Mm-hmm.
And, man, it was really good.
Yeah, good moment.
It was really, really good.
Good moment. What's your favorite Danzig song to play live?
It changes all the time.
Does it? Yeah.
Yeah, because you know how... Because you're in a band too, you're not just a wrestler, so you know that you're playing a song, and tonight it's this song.
Yeah.
And then you get tired of playing a song, but then you go out on stage, and all of a sudden, because of the audience, you like it again.
Yeah,
So it changes all the time. Yeah.
It just depends on what kind of a reaction, energy you're getting.
This last couple tours, I would just stop doing the set list, and I go, what do you guys want to hear? And we start telling them what we can play. They want to hear this record, that record. Okay, you want to hear this song? And people screaming, 80 different songs.
Did you know them all?
And then you have to start going, okay, what about this song?
Yeah, okay,
then what about this? Whoever's loudest, then we'll play that song.
Because there's always some of those songs, like maybe track number 9 on the third record that you wrote it, recorded it, and haven't thought about it since. And someone goes, would you play, Lazarus or whatever, one of our tunes? Like, I don't even remember how that goes. Like, I'm sorry, man. I wish I could whip it up, but I have no idea.
We We have a lot of songs that we practice aside from the set.
Really?
Yeah. So if we're down at rehearsal before the tour, we'll be rehearsing the set, and then we're rehearsing extra songs and just brushing up on songs that aren't in the set, so just in case we feel like doing it.
Yeah, which is good.
And so we do a lot of that. And, you know, people dig it too, so that's great.
Man, it's great talking to you. I'm excited to hear Danzig.
I'm glad we got to talk about wrestling too, because I love wrestling.
Oh, I know you do, man. And whenever I see you, I was like, hey, I can tell that you're actually happy, like, to see, like, hey, what's up, dude? You know, yeah, which is cool. Yeah, man.
No, but I'm glad you're still healthy too. That's
well, yeah. I mean, it's you know, like you said, both of us, when you've been doing this for a long, long time, to stay, you know, stay above water is pretty cool. So
yeah, no, I still have injuries from the last run.
Yeah,
cracked knee. You know.
Yeah. We still
broken other stuff, and Phil too. You know,
we still think we're 18.
In our
minds. Danzig is back fronting the original Misfits, well, at least for two Riot Fest gigs, this Friday, September 2nd in Denver. Keep an eye out for Victor from The Ascension. He's going to be there. And again on September 16th in Chicago. That's going to be huge as well. So like I said, and who knows, after these two gigs, if they decide they're having a great time, they could be doing a whole lot more. It's been over 30 years since the Misfits played the original lineup, and I'm very, very excited about it. I want to thank Glenn Danzig for taking the time to share so many great stories. And of course, not only the Misfits reunion, also be looking out for his upcoming studio album, Danzig Sings Elvis. And if you don't already have a copy of Danzig's Skeleton album, you got to get one. All cover tunes, very cool. And you know where to get it. Amazon. Use the Talk Is Jericho links and pick it up. All my Amazon links are at podcastone.com. Click on the Killer Deals button in the top right corner of the page, then hit the Talk Is Jericho button. I got Amazon links in the USA, the UK, the Canada. Every time you use the Talk Is Jericho links, Amazon kicks back a small percentage to the show to help us cover production costs. You can buy anything you can think of. There's no extra fees or hidden challenges. Just go to Podcast One, click on the Killer Deals button, the top right corner of the page, then hit the Talk Is Jericho button. Become a Talk Is Jericho Amazon warrior as well. Post a picture of what you bought, and I will follow you, and I will retweet you at Talk Is Jericho on the Twitter. All right. I want to thank all you guys for checking that out, and thank all of you guys for checking out the rest of my great sponsors, DDP Yoga. Get 20% off the DDP Yoga program, and it's going to change your life, plus 3 months of full access to the DDP Yoga Now app. Just go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho. I want to thank DraftKings. Use my promo code Y2J to play for free with your first deposit at DraftKings.com. Don't forget Indochino.com. Use my promo code Jericho to get any premium suit for just $399, and free shipping is included in that. And don't forget March 15th, 2017, only 195 days from now, when Mick Foley joins Talk Is Jericho for the biggest podcast ever. And don't forget to keep listening for the 60-second AP News headlines coming up next. Thank you guys so much for being here. We've had a lot of great shows over the last few weeks. Michael Sweet from Striper was tremendous. You know, today, of course, with Danzig, another great show. Johnny Bananas from MTV, the reality shows, man, those are grueling. Those are tough. I had no idea how much physical battering he takes to in those shows. But we got a great one coming up for you on Friday, all right? It is the Amusement Parks of America as recited by the two biggest fans of amusement parks I know, Cody Rhodes and Zack Ryder. That's right. It's Amusement Parks of America with Rhodes and Ryder, and they have got some great stories. They travel the states going to different amusement parks together with their respective girls and have wacky adventures, arguments, fights, disagreements, opinions on what rides are best. It's Zack Ryder and Cody Rhodes here on Friday talking about the Amusement Parks of America. Who's going to bring a topic such as that? Only me. We'll see you on Friday. Thank you very much. Have a safe week and a big yeah, boy.
You can download new episodes of Talk Is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.